Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. It's good to have you with us because it's February 14th. Now, my youngest is 8 today. And from the day she was born, we always thought it was so special to welcome new life on Valentine's Day, a day set aside for some special appreciation for our loved ones, which is also part of what made what happened 4 years ago today even more painful.
17 people lost their lives. 12 people within the building.
We heard the police coming down the hallway, banging on doors.
I thought I was going to die.
17, you know, casualties, 17 people that aren't going to return to their families. And to me, that's totally unacceptable.
For an entire generation of young people, this day is marred by the memory of what happened at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, on February 14th, 2018.
Just pray for this city, pray for this school, the parents, the folks that lost their lives. It's a horrific, horrific day.
After the initial shock of the deadly shooting, attention turned to the message being delivered with painful clarity by the Parkland survivors.
All these people should be at home grieving. But instead, we are up here, standing together, because if all our government and president can do is send thoughts and prayers, then it's time for victims to be the change that we need to see.
It felt like maybe this could represent an actual turning point on gun violence legislation. If only lawmakers would listen to the voices of the students who saw their classmates murdered.
Senator Rubio, can you tell me right now that you will not accept a single donation from the NRA in the future?
No, the answer to the question is that people buy into my agenda.
And the parents who lost everything that day.
It doesn't make sense. Fix it. Should have been one school shooting and we should have fixed it. And I'm pissed because my daughter I'm not going to see again.
And some local legislators were paying attention. According to Stateline, 50 laws were passed restricting access to guns between February and August of 2018. 14 of the states where those laws were passed had Republican governors. But at the federal level, little changed. In the first year of the Biden administration, with Democrats in control of Congress, no significant federal legislation on guns was passed. Data compiled by the gun safety advocacy organization Every Town for Gun Safety shows that nationwide, there were more than 200 incidents of gunfire on school grounds in 2021. It led to 49 deaths and over 100 injuries. Now, all this hour, we're going to be reflecting on what has changed and what has stayed distressingly the same in the aftermath of Parkland and other school shootings. And we wanted to start by examining the psychological and emotional toll of these shootings, both on the survivors and really on all of us, but especially on our young people who go to class every day, aware of the risks of gun violence in schools.
I'm Laura Wilson. I'm an associate professor at the University of Mary Washington.
I'm Dave Cullen. I'm the author of the books Columbine and Parkland, Birth of a Movement.
I asked Dave, what is different in the aftermath of Parkland compared to Columbine?
You know, with Columbine, it was just completely blindsided them. So many of them the day after talked about it being like a movie because that's all they could conceive of. They never saw this coming. So that was the additional, really, shock and horror, like this whole new thing to be afraid of in your life and to be terrified of. Like, oh, it's not safe to go to school. Whereas the Parkland kids, you know, some of them told me they were expecting it. And all kids to some degree now, like they know the monsters are real. And so it's still horrible when it does, but it's not also the blindsiding and just so many of the Columbine kids went into the numb phase of PTSD, which a lot of the experts I talked to said was really unusual, that high level, because it was so staggering to them.
I can remember so distinctly Columbine, every frame of every piece of film that we saw for weeks afterward. I can remember that sense, almost like a post 9/11 sense of having entered into a new part of our nation, and thinking things won't be the same after this. And that as horrifying as each one has been, there's somehow been almost like a diminishing shock to finding our schools as spaces of mass shootings.
After the one in Texas, Sutherland Springs, I think, I was with some friends who were also journalists, and a good friend of mine in the back seat was on her phone and said, oh, there's been another mass shooting. I was like, oh God, where? And she said, Texas. And I said, oh, and I changed the subject. I couldn't just go there again. I couldn't just, like, I just can't handle this again.
Professor Wilson, tell me what we know about the effects on survivors in the immediate aftermath of a mass shooting.
You know, to start, we know that exposure level is associated with the risk for post-trauma difficulties. You know, so what that means is that people who were physically injured or felt like their life was in danger are going to be at higher risk for long-term issues than an issue who maybe is more removed from the incident. And so some of the more common reactions are things like recurrent thoughts about the shooting or nightmares or feeling on edge, whereas other people might experience depression or anxiety or substance abuse. And in the hours or days after a mass shooting, almost every person who was directly exposed to the event is going to experience some level of difficulty. But the good news is that people are actually really resilient. And over time, we see most people's symptoms dissipate. But of course, we need to keep in mind that there is a subset of people that experience lingering difficulties. The impact of a mass shooting isn't just isolated to the people who were directly exposed. It definitely will kind of trickle out into the larger community. And so what we see, you know, in the field of clinical psychology is that the community's level of well-being definitely decreases. And with the level of media of exposure that we get to these types of incidents, the community really is all of us. You know, we see, you know, individuals live tweeting when they're sheltering in place, and we're hearing the fear, you know, and hearing about their experiences. And it gives us a level of exposure that, you know, decades ago we didn't have. And so we certainly do see that the impact is much larger than just those directly physically impacted in the moment.
Is this different than other kinds of traumas? So in part, as you're talking about this, I'm thinking about, you know, the experience of 9/11 or even of an interpersonal trauma that might occur as a result of abuse or violence. Is there something unique at all about the mass shooting experience and maybe particularly in the long term about that kind of sense of vulnerability?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a huge difference. You know, just as one example, the rates of chronic mental health difficulties after a mass shooting are much higher when we compare them to natural disasters like hurricanes. Now, that isn't to downplay, you know, the mental health impact of other forms of trauma. You know, those certainly are significant, you know, in and of themselves. But instead, I think it actually highlights how substantial the psychological toll of mass shootings is. And the reason that is mass shootings are a result of a person or people trying to inflict as much harm, pain, and death on a group of people as possible. And so that form of violence is associated with more significant changes in thoughts. And so it's those thoughts driving the mental health impact. And so mass shootings are going to disrupt how people think about the world or think about other people or themselves. And so it's that interpersonal malicious nature of the incident that's going to amplify the psychological consequences in survivors and the impacted community.
So Dave, as you were talking earlier, you were saying, you know, the Columbine kids or the Parkland kids. Now, the Parkland young people are still largely young people, but the Columbine kids aren't kids anymore. And I'm wondering what we know about them as adults.
You know, in the first year or two, I was most concerned about the kids who had gone through it and who seemed so much shattered. And I wasn't paying as much attention perhaps to the adults, but they didn't seem as kind of crushed by it. I'm talking about parents, teachers, and, you know, so forth. Those two sort of lines in the graph like crossed at some point, maybe 5-8 years out, where the kids by and large got past it. And actually by the 5th anniversary, I know that, like, I talked to a lot of the kids, like the news stories for the 5th year anniversary started to be about them getting past it. And then I talked to some kids much later, like Val Schnurr, 10 years out, I was talking to her and she said she started avoiding the media 5 years out because she wasn't doing better and felt kind of embarrassed. So there was another contingent of people who still took much longer, but by the 10 years she was. And really, you know, the kids would tell me that like in their own encounters with each other, when they would come back for like reunions or whatever, see each other again, it's sort of like 7, 8, 9 year, most of them had sort of moved on. And it was really telling to them that they no longer even brought it up. And like, they actually didn't want to talk about it anymore. They were just done talking about it.
I'm wondering, Professor Wilson, what is the actual psychological process that isn't necessarily about our conscious minds thinking forward to it, but that triggers us to re-experience some aspects of that trauma?
I think there's a bit of a misconception that recovery after a trauma is linear, meaning that, you know, with every hour, every day, every couple of weeks, you should be improving, you know, whatever that means for that person, and that any improvements are then maintained and you only get better. But in actuality, what we see is that symptoms come and go, new ones develop, you know, you might get kind of new sources of support. And so some symptoms might go away. And, you know, one of the biggest kind of triggers, you know, to use that word, is the anniversary of the trauma. And so, you know, that is absolutely, you know, something that we see after a mass shooting, that throughout the year, you know, in years to come, there will be moments where the individual's functioning is probably going to experience, you know, some changes. And so it's important that survivors know that, because they often experience some shame around that, thinking that, you know, well, I was doing better, you know, what have I done wrong? And so I think that that's, you know, first of all, just important for people to realize. And I think it's important for the larger community to know that, that you really need to be patient with individuals while they're figuring out what their new normal is. And I think that that's also an important thing to realize, is that these individuals will never go back to their pre-shooting self, that they're going to need to figure out what life looks like for them moving forward. And that goes for any form of trauma. You're never, you know, truly who you were before it happened. And so it's figuring out how to navigate it, you know, in the future.
Based on you having gotten to know these young folks and what you've learned in writing the books, what is it communities could do, and in fact, the broader nation, to better support survivors of mass shootings?
The one that I always come back to is don't rush the healing. I think that the single best thing we could do is just be aware of how the things you're saying might be perceived. Believe me, they are drowning in advice. They don't want your quote help, and which all they see is pushing them to like, why don't you get past this already?
Yeah, I mean, really, I agree. I think the number one word needs to be patient. What I always hear from impacted communities is they're surprised how quickly everybody else moves on. I mean, in the hours and days after a mass shooting, you know, they're at the forefront of media attention. But typically that's when they want privacy. They want to grieve. They want to kind of pause and figure out what happened. They don't want the attention. It's in the weeks, the months, and the years later, when they've had a time to kind of pause and catch their breath, that they probably do want to have a dialogue and would appreciate some support then. And by then, people have moved on to the next, you know, major news story. So, I mean, to me, it's patience and just making sure that we're in it for the long run to support them in whatever they need.
Dave Cullen is the author of the books Columbine and Parkland. And Laura Wilson is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Mary Washington and editor of the Wiley Handbook of the Psychology of Mass Shootings. It's been 10 years since the rampage at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, one of the deadliest mass shootings in U.S. history. 26 people were murdered that day, including 20 children between the ages of 6 and 7. We spoke with the parent of one of those children.
My name is Nicole Hockley, and I'm one of the co-founders and CEOs at Sandy Hook Promise.
Nicole's 6-year-old son, Dylan, was shot and killed that day, December 14th, 2012.
He was a very special little boy. He was always smiling. He had a very sing-songy, lilting voice that a lot of times people couldn't always understand him. His big brother, Jake, and myself and his dad, we could always understand him. He had a very infectious giggle, like I think a lot of kids do, but obviously I'm a very biased mother, and I thought he had the best laugh that I'd ever heard in my entire life. It was just music to my ears. He only was here for 6 years, but a lot of life and love in those 6 years.
That day started like any other. Nicole got the kids up, gave them their breakfast, and took them up the driveway to wait for the school bus. Then she went to an exercise class, and she missed a call from a friend.
And then she called back and she said, there's been a shooting at our school. I collapsed to the floor. One of my friends bundled me into a car and drove me there as close as we could get. And as we were getting closer, it was just cars everywhere and people running toward the firehouse, which is at the end of the driveway to the school. And we couldn't get any closer, so I just got out and started running too, and it was absolute chaos.
Nicole eventually found her son, Jake, who was then in the third grade, and she looked around for Dylan, but she couldn't find him or his class. Nicole and some other parents were then taken to another room.
I've heard some parents say at that moment they realized what was happening. I was clueless or in denial or, you know, we'd heard by that time that someone, that there'd been a shooting, but had no idea the scale, whether it was a shooting with injuries, whether it was just a firearm going off on the school grounds, whether one person had been shot. And I just assumed, you know, Dylan is in hiding somewhere and he's with his special education assistant, Mrs. Murphy, because she wasn't there either. Your mind can't go to the place of my child is dead. It's just not possible.
That night, Nicole and her family stayed at a friend's house. Her road was closed because the shooter had lived across the street from them.
We stayed there that night with Jake. I still remember when Ian, my husband, told Jake that Dylan had been killed. And Jake just howled. It was a sound no human should make. And it just broke him, you know? And he's probably been broken ever since. I know I am.
Before the Sandy Hook shooting, Nicole didn't know much about gun violence. But today, she's an advocate for gun violence prevention. In the aftermath of the shooting, she and another parent of a Sandy Hook victim, Mark Barden, started an organization called Sandy Hook Promise.
At Sandy Hook Promise, our mission is to ensure that no student ever faces the devastation of a school shooting. We're really working to end school shootings in our country. And we do that by educating and empowering youth with how they can prevent violence before it occurs.
One of their flagship programs is called Say Something, which teaches students to recognize warning signs of someone at risk of hurting others.
What does it look like when someone might be going into crisis? What does it look like when someone is considering harm to themselves or harm to someone else? And then how do you tell someone about that? Not to be a snitch or to get them in trouble, but to get them help. So it's really about saying something to ensure that someone gets the help that they need and not just trust that someone else is going to take care of it. So really teaching kids how to be upstanders and lean in to help each other rather than just passively think that someone else is going to take care of it.
Nicole says that empowering students is key to making schools safer, as is policy change. But while we wait for the latter, she says it's important to remember those we've lost.
To honor those who have been injured or died in a school shooting or a mass shooting, it's important to say their names. It's important to realize that we have a public health epidemic here in terms of gun violence. But if we just talk about numbers and stats, it kind of diminishes the humanity of this is a family that's no longer whole. This is a person that should be here that no longer is here. And this is something that we could have taken action to prevent.
His name was Dylan Hockley. He was 6 years old. Our thanks to Nicole Hockley, a CEO and founder of Sandy Hook Promise and the mother of Dylan. There's nothing harder than this kind of loss, and we're grateful that Nicole gave us the time and continues to fight for her son. On this day 4 years ago, the mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, prompted our nation to discuss gun violence in schools. But the reality is the overwhelming majority of lives lost and forever changed by gun violence is a daily occurrence, barely garnering headlines. In Cook County, Illinois, the area that includes the city of Chicago, more than 1,000 people died as a result of gun violence last year. And not every victim of gun violence is even the intended target of the shooter. And for all these deaths, there are many more who are physically wounded or emotionally scarred by the violence. People like my next guest.
Tiana Lofton. I'm 20 years old. I'm a sophomore at the University of New Orleans, majoring in philosophy with a concentration in public policy, ethics, and law. And I'm from Chicago, Illinois.
I asked Tiana to tell us about the day she was shot.
The year of 2020 is the year that most people probably remember as looting and COVID and all of the crazy things that came up. But I remember it as the year that I got shot and almost lost my life. On May 31st of 2020, the day that Chicago decided to loot for the murder of George Floyd, my family threw a graduation parade in the honor of me and like my sisters and my cousins graduating from like high school, college, and middle school. As we all celebrated together, everyone came out, friends and family drove past and, you know, screamed our names and celebrated. It was a great time. It was like, felt like one of the best days. And I honestly forgot what was going on, you know, around me. And afterwards, I decided to go out with some of my friends and we stopped at the local gas station right by my home, went in to buy something because the gas station had closed their doors since it was looting going on around the city. As we were just standing outside waiting, you know, to buy things, a truck pulled up and they let out shots. And I just remember in my head, it was like, it happened all so quickly. It was just like a lot of commotion and I heard just screaming and heard like the shooting. And I remember when I tried to run, I fell. And it was just like, oh, I got shot. And I remember like, I just had to like get up and move. I started to move and I was able to like sit myself up on the side and I seen my friend that I was with and she was like kind of in shock and she started to call 911. She couldn't get an answer. Like she looked at me and she was like, T, they're not answering. And when someone did answer, they told her like they're gonna call her back. The line was busy, no one could come. And I don't know, I just remember I was thinking like, you know, since preschool, you're told to call 911 if you're ever in a situation, if you're ever in danger. And this is my first time ever being in a situation like this. So I was kind of shocked and I just thought to call my mother. And I remember I was like, I gave her my phone. I'm like, call my mom. She called my mom and I stayed right down the street from the gas station that we were at. So when I called my mom and I was telling her like, mom, I just got shot and nobody's coming. Like I need help. She got to me and she got to me just in time. And I remember she got me in the truck and we had to get to the hospital. And on the way to the hospital, it was kind of just like the city was kind of just going into chaos. I remember we seen a police officer and he was standing outside his car and my mom stopped her car and she was like, my baby's shot. Like, can you help us? We need help. And he looked at us and my window was down and I looked at him and I was like, I'm shot. And he was like, keep driving, just keep driving. And I remember nobody like scared us. He didn't turn his lights on. And we was just like, huh? And he was just like, keep driving.
Okay, quick pause, take a second to breathe, right back with more on gun violence in the U.S. on The Takeaway.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Amber Ruffin has been a Black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as Black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I've been speaking with 20-year-old college student Tiana Lofton about the day she was shot. She continues her story of survival.
Once we made it to Little Company of Mary, I went in there and they instantly got to like poking me with IVs and stuff. I was there for like 2 hours. I got a blood transfusion and a COVID test, and they finally transferred me to the nearest trauma unit, which is Christ Medical Center. And once I got to Christ, I went into emergency surgery, where they put like a rubber tube, replaced that. A couple hours later, they did a bypass surgery, took a vein from my leg and put it in my arm. And then from that point, I had to stay home from college. I was actually a very big-headed little kid on going to LSU. I wanted to attend that college very badly, but things had changed drastically when I got shot in my arm because it was my dominant hand, and I had to stay home for 6 months to learn how to use my arm again. And so I had to change my plans around, and I just kind of realized I wanted something different. I wanted something more smaller, more personal, a smaller school, more in the city. And so I found UNO, and it was kind of just like a God's calling, a God's plan, because it was like really out of the blue. And I just remember after my, like, I did like 7-6 months of occupational therapy, and immediately when I was like cleared, I came off to school, and I only took a semester off, so I came that spring of last year, and I've been here ever since, and I can't complain. I'm just happy to be here.
Now, recovering from the physical injuries is one part. The other is, I mean, you know, you are clearly, I can see the size of your personality, even though I can't see you. I can only hear you. But I can hear your joy, your determination, you know, as you said, being a little bit, you know, stubborn and but also willing to see the blessings in the new opportunities that have opened. But I do worry sometimes about young, brilliant, hardworking, capable Black girls, because I wonder if there is more sadness under there or more trauma. And I'm wondering about if you're feeling recovered from the emotional and the psychological part of this.
I'm 20 now, but for my 19th birthday last year, I actually had looked into like a therapist, and I got my first psych therapist, and she helped me a lot, actually. And we had many conversations, and many times we just talked about problems, and not even that, but like with my friends and just the people that I surrounded myself around before I got shot. I did work with a community group called Brave. It's with St. Sabina in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And Father Flager.
Yeah, Father Flager, my guy. And with Father Flager, he had a group under him, and it was called Brave. And Brave stands for Bold Resistance Against Violence Everywhere. And it was basically where teens around Chicago worked together to speak out against gun violence and speak out for more resources and try to get, like, non-prevention gun violence programs going on in the neighborhood or mental health homes and things like that. And from me doing that, I had made lots of connections with good people who was really in tune with getting, like, change in Chicago and trying to better it. And so once I actually became a victim of gun violence and I still decided to speak out and use my voice, they were there. And I just will forever be thankful for that support. So when I was going through things and I just needed someone to talk to, I always talked to them. And I still tell people to this day that I love to do activist work and speak out for Chicago, because like, I'm not the first person shot in Chicago. I'm not the first person shot in my neighborhood. I'm from Auburn Gresham on the south side of Chicago, where someone is shot every 2 minutes. Yet the nearest hospital is 15 minutes away and the nearest trauma unit is 20 to 25. I honestly don't know how long we have to say that. That is unacceptable.
Thank you to Tiana Lofton, survivor and activist, for joining us today. In the aftermath of the Parkland shooting, the young people of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School brought us a wave of national activism.
Silence! No more silence and gun violence! No more silence!
Enough is enough!
Enough is enough!
What do we want?
Justice!
What do we want?
Now!
No more silence!
The Parkland, Florida teens took to social media. They spoke out on cable news, they testified before Congress, and they amassed one of the largest youth protests in U.S. history. We recently spoke with one of the Parkland teens, who's now a 20-something, who was at the front and center of that movement.
Hi, I'm David Hogg, a co-founder of March for Our Lives and a current college student.
I started by asking David how much he and his peers are defined by that day 4 years ago.
The best way that I've learned to heal to as much as possible from what has happened, as I think some of my other classmates and you know, people in Parkland in general have done to some extent, is remembering to let what happened to us not you know, stop us from enjoying the things that we love and the things that, you know, we have left despite what happened that day. And for me, that's really learning a lot of the time and hanging out with my friends and learning that to not feel guilty, to be a college student, to live my life and do the things that I enjoy. Because I think for many of us, you know, the survivor's guilt is a real thing. And I think this adjustment has been one that's been completely transformative to me. It's made me grow a lot as a person. And it's made me reflect a lot on what's happened over these past 4 years. And now that I'm 21 years old, I'm almost 22. And we started 4 years ago when I was, you know, 17. I've begun to process and realize the true magnitude of how incredible the work is that we've done and that we continue to do, but also how wrong it is that we had to do that as young people, that we really were just kids. And frankly, how epically many of the adults in power at the time, not all of them, but many of them failed us, and how it's incumbent on our generations to work to become the adults that we had some of, but had far too few of.
What is your 21, almost 22-year-old self saying to your 17-year-old self these days?
I think what my 21-year-old self is saying to my 17-year-old self is that, you know, what you went through is something that is not normal by any sense. And that although it is important for us to focus on making this change, you can't let, you know, survivor's guilt and things like that drive everything that you do. You have to do it because you want to, and you have to learn how to build a community of people around you and understand that taking care of yourself and doing the things that you enjoy and learning new things is not something to feel guilty about. It's an essential part of working in any movement, because that self-care aspect and learning to live my life despite everything like that happened, as I know for many of us that were co-founders of the organization and students in general, that's one of the bigger struggles, is just learning. It's not about moving on. It's about adapting to a new kind of horrifying normal, where we continue to see gun violence every day on TV, but we have to learn how to mentally isolate ourselves from that and learn to enjoy the things that we do have left.
One of the guests for this show that I spoke with is someone who had both met and talked with survivors of Columbine and then met and talked with survivors of Parkland. And he said something that caught me a little bit off guard at the time that he said it. He said that the young people in Columbine were completely shocked that it was an unprecedented experience prior. And that when he talked with young people at Parkland, that they had a sense of, not that it was normal, but that it was almost expected. And I'm wondering how you react to that.
I think, unfortunately, that's the incredibly dystopic reality that many young people most people, most young people and older people to live in the United States, especially in our schools, but also in our communities on a daily basis, where, you know, young people often talk about, you know, school shootings or the possibility of one happening. And it's not that they necessarily expect it to happen to them, but they know that it happens everywhere. So I think when what happened in Parkland happened, we were obviously in a bit of shock, but to say that it would be completely unexpected that this could ever happen in the United States would just not be true. It's not like we necessarily expect it to happen to us, but we know it's going to happen to some amount of people. So when it does happen to you, it's not necessarily totally surprising because it continues to happen. And it's horrifying.
It does continue to happen. It's been 4 years, and yet Parkland is not like, oh, remember when that used to happen. It's instead,
unfortunately,
the two year and the 1 year. Why are we failing to do anything?
You know, I've thought a lot about this over the past couple of years. And the answer that I've settled on is that, you know, when we turned out in 2018, when we went on the news and talked to, you know, about what had happened and how ridiculous it is that we're in this situation and everything like that, we said the adults failed us. We said, we need you to do your job because we're trying to do ours and study and get through our classes and do our homework, right? Our worry shouldn't be whether or not we're going to literally survive high school. And the adults said to us in response, okay, help us change who's in power by voting. And we did. We voted at one of the highest rates ever in American history in 2018. And we had some, you know, minor successes at the federal level. Granted, we didn't change any laws per se at the federal level because of the filibuster and different aspects of Congress, but we did change them at the state level. We changed them in a deeply, deeply Republican legislature in Florida. That is a huge success. And on top of that, we, you know, we got changes added to how gun violence prevention research is getting it actually funded and making sure that things like the Dickey Amendment don't get in the way of it and various other things like that. And what I've thought about over these years is after we did turn out at record numbers, at one of the highest rates ever in American history in 2018, and we also turned out at the highest rate ever in American history for young people in 2020, we elected some of the most pro-gun violence prevention candidates in American history, Joe Biden being included. What I've come to realize is that the movement is not broken. It's our government that's broken. It's our government that has been extremely corrupted, because what I think about is a movement of millions of young people walking out from their high schools and voting and voting at such high rates and everything like that should have been able to change something, especially considering that we literally changed all the power in the House and the Senate and the presidency.
David, you talked a little bit about not having survivor's guilt and or working through managing survivor's guilt and and being sure that you continue to do things that you love and finding new things. What are some of the new things that you've discovered that you love and care about?
For one, it's being a college student. Honestly, in my first year, I was not taking care of myself. I was still being driven a lot by the survivor's guilt that I had. I was traveling every weekend, going to different states, trying to get the word out about the organization, trying to help, you know, build up our team more and things like that. And it just got to a point where my, frankly, like the trauma that I have not, that I had, not just from the shooting, but, you know, the death threats and everything that I know many students, you know, who don't get interviews on NPR, for example, have as well, was really coming back to me. And I had to fully step back and realize, I just need to focus on being a college student and realize that me doing the things that I love is a form of resistance. And it is part of the movement, because what it took me realizing is that the movement of gun violence prevention is made up of all these individuals, that many of whom are survivors and have a massive amount of trauma, of course. But we have to realize, if those individuals are not taking care of themselves, then the movement is not taking care of itself. And in that sense, the most selfish thing you could do is to not live your life and not take care of yourself, because then other people have to take care of you, and it detracts from other parts of the movement. So learning to be a college student is one of those things, along with picking up, you know, different hobbies, you know, talking about history, which is what I'm studying in school, especially American history, and discussing that, and meeting with my professors and hanging out with friends after class and going to parties and stuff like that. It's really about learning to be a college student and not feeling guilty about it. That's been the most healing, but also one of the most challenging things for me, is learning to let go.
This is the worst question you can ever ask a college senior, but I'm going to ask you anyway. So what's next for you?
Yeah, well, for the time being and into the foreseeable future from what I know, you know, but people change over time. You know, I'm going to continue working with March for Our Lives as a board member and helping lead it. But what our bigger emphasis is on is making sure that the organization doesn't necessarily need to have one person or two people or three people, you know, that are out front, that are spokespeople for it, because it's a movement of young people, first and foremost. And I'm not always necessarily going to be a young person, unfortunately. But, you know, I think what's next is figuring out how to bring in more young people, you know, into the organization, or continuing to do that and train them up in the best way that they can be, so they can be in these really higher level leadership positions that most people are not in until they're, you know, in their, often in their 40s or mid 50s on serving on things like boards and things like that, and learning how to kind of challenge those barriers that a lot of young people face, because we are a youth led organization. That is the whole goal of it. Now we have some slightly older, you know, young people that have graduated college that we employ to help, you know, make things happen while we're in college, but you know, we're on the ground doing it and everything like that. And I think what's next for me is I'm considering law school, but I'm also wary of how much it costs. So I'm trying to figure out, I might take a couple of years off to try to save up for that if I decide to go, but you know, I don't know. I have a variety of interests that I'm curious in doing, one of which is social entrepreneurship and a number of other things. But, you know, these are all things that are up in the air. I could change my mind tomorrow and decide to become something completely different, because that's what, as I'm sure you can relate, what college is kind of like. But yeah, I think regardless of whatever it is, I will always be invested in March for Our Lives and working in the movement to help change this issue.
David Hogg is a gun violence prevention activist and a co-founder of March for Our Lives. Thank you for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you.
I am Congresswoman Robin Kelly, the Congresswoman of the 2nd Congressional District of Illinois.
In 2012, Robin Kelly was elected to Congress. Her district, the Illinois 2nd, includes parts of Southside Chicago marred by what can feel like unrelenting gun violence. And she's been a champion of gun reform since the moment she arrived in the House. She now serves as chair of the Congressional Gun Violence Prevention Task Force. Way back in 2014, Representative Kelly released a gun violence report, and she told me just how much things have changed or not since then.
Unfortunately, things have not changed that much. As you probably know, we've passed pieces of legislation in the House that we can't seem to get passed in the Senate, universal background checks, closing the Charleston loophole so that it would be a longer period of time when someone wants to buy a gun that they can just get the gun, like what happened in Charleston. It wasn't a definitive no, so he was sold the gun, but then it came back a few days later that he should not have had the gun. So there has not been much change since that 2014 report. In fact, you know, the last couple of years, it's gotten worse in many places.
Indeed, this point about things having gotten worse, and, you know, over the course of the show today, we're really talking about mass shootings as we're marking the anniversary of Parkland, and we're thinking about mass shootings, particularly mass school shootings. But in fact, that's a relatively narrow view of gun violence.
Definitely. You're speaking to my heart, because I think that's the voice that I carry to Congress, that we always, you know, spoke about mass shootings, not that they are not absolutely tragic. And we used to do moments of silence. We'd stand up, sit down, then we would do nothing. And I, you know, brought to Congress where I represent and other places, people die every day. They may not die with anybody else, but it's someone's child or mother or father or cousin. And we never talk about that. We talk about it more now, you know, and that was one of the impetuses for mass shootings and for, you know, individuals dying every day on the streets. I call it a slow motion massacre.
Indeed, as you were saying, you know, we would stand up and sit down. And even as you said that, like in my head, I could see that image of you there with the late Congressman John Lewis sitting on the floor of the House of Representatives, because you all had gotten to a point where you're like, this must change. We must do something. And I can remember feeling at that moment like, ah, maybe this is finally it. But then
it wasn't. It wasn't it, because too often people don't even think about it until it happens close to them. You know, it happens over there when people say, I can't believe it happened in this area, but you can believe it happened in my area, but you can't believe it happened. But, you know, people realize it more and more, but basically we cannot get it passed. And it's not just about universal background checks and things like that. In the Build Back Better piece of legislation, we have $5 billion for violence prevention. And it was about investing in communities and neighborhoods and programs that are already in existence and proving themselves to be worthy and effective. But again, as you know, we couldn't get that passed either. But we're not giving up on it.
So talk to me a little bit about why. I mean, some of what you just described are things that public opinion polls have shown us for two decades, that the vast majority of Americans, gun owners included, by the way, I'm a gun owner, right? And across the ideological spectrum, across both parties, support. So what is it that's standing in the way of some of these very common sense basic measures?
You know, I do think that gun owners need to make their voices heard more. And just like the head of the Gun Violence Prevention Task Force is Representative Mike Thompson, guns are his hobby, you know, and there's other gun owners. Val Demings is, you know, on it. Benny Thompson was on it. I'm not sure he is anymore. These are all gun owners that believe in gun safety. And I think we need people like you. You know, my son is a gun owner. The people like you to speak up more and say this is important. In fact, the Gun Violence Prevention Task Force, we just went over a survey that gun owners who believe in gun safety, suggestions they have, you know, and it can't be, oh, they just want to take away your gun. You know, we have to relax people in that way. If you have your gun legally and you're not trying to hurt yourself or anybody else, have your gun, you know, but people just think that we want to take their guns away. We could never take everyone's guns away, first of all, and we want people to be safer with their guns. You know, if your gun is stolen, please report it, or, you know, things like that. Teach your children, you know, about gun safety, just a lot of different things. If you notice something, report it. Like when you think about the school shootings and all the kids that killed kids. And you mean to tell me the parents never noticed anything? Or the case that's just up, I can't remember which state it is, where they did arrest the mother and the father. Mm-hmm. We all have to do our part.
You know, it's an interesting point that with this kind of, I feel like these constant roadblocks around even the most common sense policy, I so appreciate the point you're making that, you know, responsible gun ownership is something that if you're a gun owner, you ought to take a lot of pride in and want to spread, right? Like, I'm mostly a gun owner because my dad was. We're very Southern. We're just very Southern, right? But there's also so much pride in sort of, you know, my children know how to use these weapons. We would never leave it unlocked or outside of a safe, right? You'd never leave it loaded. Like there's like the rules that you go through. Military families, for example, you know, may have firearms in the house, law enforcement families having firearms in the house, and taking pride in being careful and acknowledging that weapons like this actually shouldn't be in every single household.
Exactly. And, you know, I grew up in a law enforcement family in New York, and we had a mom and pop grocery store. And my grandfather had his rifle in the back of the store, you know, protecting his property. We climbed over that rifle every day. If you wanted to go to the bathroom, that's where the rifle was, and you had to climb over it. Never in my mind would I think about picking it up, playing with it, because we were taught you don't do that. You have to be responsible. And I guess that's the big thing that I don't want people to think, because we're saying we need background checks, we need this, that everyone's anti-gun, because that is simply not the case. Simply not the case. But we have to do better. We have to give law enforcement, ATF, you know, the tools and the resources they need to do the job. Like, people always talk about Chicago, oh, you have the strictest laws, you have this, that, and the other. yes, Chicago does, but the trafficking that occurs across state lines is horrible. The store purchasing, which leads to trafficking, is horrible. Most of Chicago's crime guns do not come from Chicago or Illinois, for that matter.
Tell me about the Federal Firearms Licensee Act.
Okay, the Federal Firearms Licensee Act would update the U.S. code around how federal firearms licensees secure guns and prevent theft. It conducts inventory and record data for background checks. So just another way of keeping guns more secure, knowing inventory, trying to prevent theft in any way. And also increases physical security measures and clarifying standards around licensing for dealers and increasing gun transfer record retention. So you know who you sold your gun to. None of this back alley or outdoor selling the guns, knowing who the guns are sold to. And the thing is, you know, we know when you buy a car, you know, where you bought the car from, you know, who you sold the car to, just when you buy a house, you know, we track so many things, but, you know, guns have been carved out of so many things.
So as you pointed out, part of the unique voice that brought you to Congress was to represent those families and communities impacted by daily gun violence. And I'm wondering, as you talk to your constituents and others, if those communities feel invisible or if they feel that they're being heard and that the losses and agony that they're enduring matters to other people.
No, they know that I'm out there fighting for them every day. I've become, you know, friends with so many of them, but also they do feel a great frustration. And some have said to me, you know, when a police officer kills one person, there's a lot of attention, a lot of, you know, there's marching, there's this, there's that, there's the other, as there should be. I'm not saying there shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to community crime on crime, you know, people cannot let that become normal. You know, a big deal needs to continue to be made, you know, out of that also. We just had a press conference not too long ago, and, you know, listening to an 11-month-old got shot, and in the Chicagoland area, you know, driving down the expressway, people have gotten shot, and just on and on and on. And I know not just in Chicago has risen, and I'm sure COVID has, you know, something to do with the trauma people feel, but I think they feel some people listen to them. They're very frustrated, you know, with some lawmakers because they do feel like they don't care, you know, and if it happened more in some other neighborhoods, would that get attention? But really, I don't know. You know, it's just, it's become too normalized. It's become such a part of the culture, you know. I mean, when kids say they don't even know if they're going to live to 20 or they don't want to play in the park, people don't want to walk to the store, they don't want to walk to school because they're afraid, that's not right.
You're on the national stage. You are a member of the U.S. House, and you are also leading the Illinois Democratic Party. Talk to me a little bit about what it means to be doing leadership at a more state and local level.
Well, when I first got involved in government, it was the very local level where I live now. And I've actually worked on every level of government, the county. I was a state rep and a state employee. We need to pay attention to what's going on in the states. You know, I'm a Democrat, so we need to make sure we are paying attention and we're building the bench, not just, you know, about who's president or who's the senator. That is all very important. But who's your school board member? Who's your mayor? Who's your county person? Who's your state rep? That's very, you know, very, very important, too. And we can't lose people. You know, I want to welcome Democrats back home that might have felt ignored. I want to welcome young people, people of different ethnicities. I'm really trying to make the Democratic Party more open, more transparent, more present, more active, and let everyone know that you're voice matters, your opinion matters, no matter what zip code you live in, whether you're urban, suburban, or rural. You know, we are truly all in this together, and I want to help people feel that way again so they stay involved.
Representative Robin Kelly, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
You're quite welcome.
That's all we have for you today. Thanks for sticking with us. I know it was an emotional show, and we'll be sure to continue to cover these important stories for you. And to underline the continuing grief and the determination of those most personally touched by gun violence, you need look no further than Washington, D.C., where today, Manuel Oliver, whose son Joaquin was shot and killed 4 years ago during the Parkland shooting. Well, he climbed 150 feet to the top of a construction tower near the White House and unveiled a banner demanding legislation to regulate the availability of guns. Manuel has been a fierce advocate for gun reform since his son was murdered. And since that tragic day, he's been among the many pushing Congress to pass some kind of common sense gun legislation. But as Representative Kelly just told us, little has changed. We here at The Takeaway want to send out to him and to everyone who suffered on that day and all the days since, strength and hope. And we're going to continue to cover these tough stories for them and for you. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Meet me right back here tomorrow.